a moment before the door closed behind her, had poked her head out and smiled at me. Dad said, "Goodness, what a cutie." My ears heated up, and in we went. I won't spend too much time on Reverend Johnny, because what happened there isn't half as important as what was happening at home. But did you ever go to church and see the minister rise first thing with a trumpet in his hand? That's what Reverend Johnny did. Oh, yes. Our mild roofing Methodists were unused to musical instruments, except organs and pianos. But they took to this trumpet right away, and the Reverend played like Gabriel, by which I mean loud and with the authority that comes of a good ear and large lungs. A great big fellow, Reverend Johnny Latt, had to be in his 70s, yet still so upright and wide in the shoulders, and with such dark swept back hair, he could have walked without fear down your choice of midnight alleys. He had with him a saxophonist younger brother, an organist wife with a soft voice and a sweet shipwrecked expression at the eyes, and a heavy, weak-looking son, who played of all things the flute, and who you knew straight off wouldn't be the one to carry the Latt Crusades far into the future. The music alone lasted as long as our normal Wednesday night service. Fine music, I believe to this day, and well-tuned, and performed to the glory of God, but all the same uncommonly loud. My head throbbed after half an hour. For relief, I looked sideways, where through the rising heat, Bethany looked cool as a May morning. On we bore through He Leadeth Me and The Old Rugged Cross, and shockingly, When the Saints Go Marching In, at which I felt, rather than heard, Dad chuckle. On through a trumpeted rendition of Shall We Gather at the River, at once so beautiful and so calamitously loud I could have wept for either reason. Peeking sideways, Bethany glimpsed my eye on her. Onward, Christian soldiers! Nearing the hour mark, I closed my eyes and saw a picture of myself from the side, a runnel of blood sliding out of my ear. This, followed by a glance to find Bethany gone, and I rose from my seat and slouched from the sanctuary. Feeling Dad's gaze, I turned and sought his approval. Reverend Johnny was well into a bold rendering of Amazing Grace, standing tall, not leaning back as jazz trumpeters do, but straight and wide as a Roman pillar, the sound growing out of him with no hint of approaching abatement. The Reverend had chops not a jazz man in the world would have argued with. And as I pushed open the swinging door, still looking back, Dad rendered some grace of his own, winking at me to go ahead, take a break, understanding that the trumpet in its glorious proximity was hero enough for any mortal ears. I found Bethany downstairs in the kitchen, peeling an orange from the Westinghouse drawer. When I put my head in at the door, she said, "Reuben, are you hungry?" "Sure." "Come on, I'll share it with you." Bethany Orchard was 12, only a year ahead of me at school, but in the universal race children run toward the doubtful prize of maturity, she was leagues out in front, a realization that arrived as soon as I stood with her in the basement of Roofing Methodist, and she fed me orange slices with her fingers. Not my fault, I'd reached for the orange. She said, "No, let me, here." As she peeled the sections away one by one, a locust-like buzz entered the back of my brain. I'd been pleased at first to realize I was slightly taller than Bethany, but her fingers, approaching with an orange slice, reaffirmed the gulf between us. Her fingers were long, capable, conversant. A woman's fingers, slightly reddened from some recent scrubbing. Her fingers were the oldest part of her. I couldn't think of a thing to do with this information. I couldn't think of anything at all. The locust neared. The bits of orange her fingers placed in my mouth were so ripe I barely chewed. Overhead, the music changed and slowed. When the orange was gone, I dared look at Bethany, who showed nothing but a businesslike attitude, sweeping the cupped peelings into a palm and lobbing them into a wastebasket. She was without shame. Afraid she'd go back upstairs, I said, "I cook meals at our house sometimes." She looked at me, and I was like Kipling's jungle beasts who couldn't meet the eye of man. I commenced hunting about the kitchen, opening cupboards as if with a purpose. Coming up at last with a box of Bisquick and a pound of butter from the Westinghouse, Bethany said, "I think there's some syrup over the stove." I'm afraid we missed the Reverend Johnny's sermon, though I recognized full well when the music stopped and the preaching began. By then, Bethany and I had moved on to whisks and bowls and eggs of ambiguous purity, and the gladness of being alone with this girl was stronger than the unease I felt at putting one over on Dad, who was expecting me back upstairs. What brought us up at last was a case of alarm, a hard thump from overhead, as if Reverend Johnny had received some coronary visitation. A light fixture wobbled. We froze and heard the Reverend's voice, jagged and intermittent. A second thump rattled the fixture. Somebody shouted, "Amen!" And then it was as if Armageddon opened out above us. Such salvos of thumps and whacks shook the church. Imagine a storm hailing whole arms and legs. Did we zip? Up the steps and a sliding stop at the sanctuary door, where I heard an urgent voice say approximately, "Bam! Tubale! Skumba! Rafe!" Straight off, a different voice raised up to translate. "I am among you tonight, my children," it said, amid blooming amens. Cracking the door, we saw the Reverend Johnny Latt reach out to touch a man on the forehead. It was Mr. Layton, who'd stood behind his dime store counter these endless years, an egregious miser and congenital grouch. The Reverend's eyes were shut, and as his fingers touched Mr. Layton's bright scalp, Mr. Layton fell backward without utterance, slipping between the ineffectual arms of the younger Latt brother, who'd crept up behind to make the catch. The impact had no visible effect on Mr. Layton, who lay at peace in a room littered with supine Methodists. Reverend Johnny opened his eyes and peered around for others in range. There was a pressure on my arm that I recognized as Bethany's hand. I looked into her face, her close, scared face. She asked in a whisper if they were all right, these folks lying about. It's true, the place raised neck hairs. "They're fine," I said, looking for Dad, who'd know.
"Therianus diguanus mernore gunganus,"
a man called out, plus a paragraph or so more. I'm not making fun. The language was complicated and musical, an expression outside human usefulness. Expectant silence followed. The Reverend Johnny surveyed the room. At this moment, I noticed that the smell of our pancakes, Bethany's and mine, and they'd been good ones, had floated upstairs, a fabulous smell. It occurred to me we might get into some small trouble for using the kitchen during service. Then the Reverend Johnny spoke up.
"Does someone have the interpretation? Who's hearing the word of the Lord tonight?"
Nobody said a thing. Johnny Latt persisted.
"Someone's fighting obedience tonight! Speak up, for no prophecy goes untold. Joe, is it you?"
And Joe, a bull-shouldered patriarch, whose shirt stretched wet across his back and who looked to be in deep communication with the Almighty, rose without hesitation and gave it a shot.
"Oh, my sons and my daughters, how I love thee, how I wish to provide for thee. Yea, I long to surround thee with delicious smells, heavenly smells. How gladly will I sit thee down in my banquet hall, for beauteous are the cakes therein. Oh, golden is my syrup, and unto me shall gather the hungry from every nation."
What a shame Swede wasn't there. She'd have adored that prophecy. Who knows what commentary she'd have whispered in my ear. But my wheels turn a beat or two slower than Swede's. And anyhow, Bethany's hold had whitened on my arm.
"Oh, Reuben," she said, "your dad's down."
He was stretched on his back right up by the pulpit, as if he'd been first to go. I had a fleeting sense of forsakenness. I was marooned. Though I knew most everyone here, the sight of Dad out cold on the floor momentarily tipped bedrock. I pushed open the door and went to him, stepping, I'm afraid, on some innocent hands. It was like walking out of a plane crash. Dad looked comfortable, though, arms above his head, feet pointed inward. Some of the others' eyes were twitching beneath the lids. Not Dad's. He looked exactly like he did on the odd sleep-late Saturday morning when he'd worked long at school the night before, appreciative, vaguely surprised, and above all, unconscious. I knelt at his side. But how do you wake a man knocked cold by love? Because as he told me later, that's what it was, the electric, unearned love of the great Creator, traveling like light down the nerves of the Reverend Johnny's arm, crackling out the tips of his fingers. I looked at Dad's face, at creases I'd never noticed, the nape of loosening skin at his throat. In that instant, it seemed to me he deserved to rest this way for days and days. Then a jolt hit my shoulder, and I felt hands shaking me as if jarring something loose. Light snapped in my eyes, my ears plugged and opened, and there was a sudden easing in my lungs that showed me how hard I'd been working to breathe. Charged with fear and oxygen, I turned to see who had a hold of me. No one did. No one, in fact, was near me except the Reverend Johnny, now talking casually with his younger brother. He wasn't even looking at me. But his hand, his right hand, was brushing my shoulder. I can feel it still, that sizzling jump inside my organs. It didn't feel good, not as I would have suspected the touch of the Lord might feel. But I wouldn't say it felt bad, either. It only felt powerful, like truth unhusked. Once torched by truth, Swede wrote years later, "A little thing like faith is easy." Had I her gift for getting to the core, I'd be tempted to chew on this a while, on truth and its odd conduits. But a witness must obey his strengths, and mine, forgive me, lie in keeping the story moving. So here's where my father wakes. He sits upright, and his eyes are wide and troubled. And, "Son," he says, "we have to leave." Because he knows, somehow, what we've done. We've stayed too long at church. So let us leave. Let us get to the Plymouth with an impolite quickness. Let us fly, as witnesses of eras past might say. Because at home, the hard and escalating war has paid a visit. And it's Swede, my darling sister, who has met it at the door. Your Toughened Heart. A canyon dim and deep and cool was where he'd made his lair, a labyrinthian cavern strewn with bits of bone and hair. It smelled within of smoke and sin and blasphemy and dread, and none would choose to walk that way who were not walking dead. Yet down the quiet canyon wall a weary rider came, a rider bent with grief, yet bent on justice all the same. And while storm clouds rise on high and ruin moans and grates, the rider sundown draws his colt, and Valdez grins and waits. Swede was alone in the house. Dad and I were at church, of course, and Davy was in the garage loft working on a secret, Swede's 9th birthday being 2 days off. Who could imagine someone would come to the door in plain sight such a lovely October evening with evil in his heart? Who understands such hatred as bedeviled that doomed visitor? Who would believe his boldness as he knocked? But Dad had spoken correctly. They did not know they'd already lost. Israel Finch didn't know it as he heard Swede running to answer the door. Davy didn't know it as he worked in the garage, soaping years off a stretch of brain-tanned leather. Swede certainly didn't know it as she scuffed and lurched across the yard toward a smoking Chevy with Tommy Baska at the wheel and Israel's hand against her mouth. Oh, no. Swede didn't know it at all. What Swede knew was that seconds ago she'd been writing down rhymes to describe the Bandit King Valdez, daring eagle-hearted thief, and he who of these hills is chief. Growing a soft spot for the bad guy, like every other writer since Milton. Well, no more. The bitter taste of Israel Finch's palm, his unwashed smell, her own terror at the proximate unknown. All this took the sheen off villainy. Thus does a romantic canyon hideout, an outlaw palace built of rock, become a smelly sinhole strewn with bits of bone and hair. No more sympathy for Valdez, boy. Now sundown's wound is seeping, and he's tilting as he rides. His eyes are red and gritty as he scans the canyon sides. He hadn't known the nature of the man whose track he sought, and it sickened him to death to see the things Valdez had wrought. One day an upturned stagecoach and its driver's ghastly hue, the next a blackened farmhouse and its family blackened too. So many graves had sundown dug, his hands were chapped and sore, and now he prayed to God for strength to live and dig one more. Israel made her sit on his lap in the Chevy. Tommy pulled away from the house, dumb as any good chauffeur. And when they'd gone a few blocks, Israel took his hands from her mouth and said, "Now, you see how easy that was?" I won't give a detailed account of the ensuing 20 minutes. I wasn't there. Later, Swede would characterize the interlude as a small and dirty time. And though in these days of abductions and mayhem and bodies turning up in ditches, Swede's ordeal might seem almost innocuous, to think of it still hurts me physically. I feel it churning yet. A 9-year-old shouldn't be dragged from her house by someone who hates her, nor be forced to hear the language of the unloved, nor be jiggled in the laps of perverts. A 9-year-old shouldn't be told, "We'll take you home now, but we'll be back. We're right outside your window." And now, because a story is told for all, an admonition to the mind sick. Be careful whom you choose to hate. The small and the vulnerable own a protection great enough, if you could but see it, to melt you into jelly. Beware those who reside beneath the shadow of the wings. The first Davy knew of Swede's capture was her return. Finishing his work in the garage, he cleaned his hands on a rag and came into the house to make coffee, entering the back door just as Swede slammed in the front. Her shoulders were bent forward and she cross-cupped her elbows in her palms. She was not crying. Her face was white. Davy saw her looking thus and swept her up and smelled at that moment the oil-smoke rush of the departing Chevrolet. That night, I eavesdropped on the grown-ups again, Dad and Davy, and Ted Pullet, the town cop, drinking coffee in the kitchen. Swede was asleep, for real, which somehow made me fearful. That and Pullet's manner. He sat there talking to Dad in tones so reasonable I suspected he wasn't even on our side. "I'll talk to those boys in the morning, Jeremiah. I swung over there after you called on my way here. They aren't home, either of them." See what I mean? Those boys? I swung over there? I didn't understand how Pullet could be so casual. I slipped out of bed and peeked in the kitchen. Dad said, "You can do better than talk, Ted. You know Finch." "Well, you said yourself they didn't hurt your girl." Davy hadn't wanted to call Pullet at all. This was Finch and Bosca's third offense, and as far as Davy was concerned, their woeful moon had risen. He had his jacket on and car keys in hand when Dad pulled rank and called the law. Waiting, Davy asked, "How many times does a dog have to bite before you put him down?" And now here came Pullet with his timid logic. "You gave them a pretty bad scare that night in the locker room, Jeremiah. They're just kicking back a little. Bosca's aunt wanted you arrested, you know." Pullet smiled, but his fingers shook on the rim of his cup. Davy got up from the table at this, set his coffee down, and left the house. Pullet watched him go. "Jeremiah," he said, "you of all people should understand young men who might get overheated." "They pulled her out of the house, Ted, her own home, threatened her, put their hands on her." A pause, then again, "You know Finch?" This referred to Israel Finch's departure from school the previous year. One day he got up to leave in the middle of remedial math. The teacher, young and uncertain of his authority, moved cautiously to block the door. Israel seized the teacher by the hair and bent him toward the floor. Wordless, on his knees, the teacher closed his eyes, and Israel Finch let go the hair and stepped back and delivered a kick to the stomach that took the teacher's wind and ruptured something inside. The class went numb. The teacher slumped. The noise his head made hitting the floor started 3 girls crying at once. Israel left roofing and went briefly to a reformatory, which failed to prove up to the name. By the time he returned, Tommy Bosca had quit school also, his options there seeming limited. "I'll talk to them in the morning," Pullet said, but by now I recognized the fear inside his voice. He was no good to us. This he would verify the very next day, returning after visits with Finch and Bosca to tell Dad that those boys were just playing, kicking around, had meant no harm. I remember the clear contempt in Davy's eyes and the set of his mouth as he listened to this folly. I remember hoping Ted Pullet wouldn't look up at his expression and take offense, though now I understand poor Ted must have known it was there. must have felt it, must have chosen against seeing it. Swede, for her part, said nothing to me about Finch and Bosca. The day after it happened, we went to school as always, and getting home, she somewhat forcefully pulled out her little hard-headed doll with eyes that closed when you laid it down, a toy that hadn't seen daylight in months. She carried it about, changed its clothes impatiently, ran a brush over its stiff hair. But the doll had a grievous, unmothered expression, as if it knew its time was short. Once, as Swede was rocking it, her blouse rode up, and I saw two black thumb-like marks down low on her side. That night I went into her room and found her working fiercely at her tablet and the doll nowhere in sight. "Just writing," Swede told me, but I knew she was doing more than that. She was killing off Valdez. And in the morning, she turned 9 years old, in a reckless celebration defying all dread. We sneaked early to her bedroom, where she lay awake, pretending otherwise according to tradition. In the gray light, I discerned her lips in a tight smile, and her eyes fluttering behind the lids. Then Dad softly sang, "Happy Birthday." And she sat up in bed, rubbing her eyes like some storybook child. A beautiful sight. I can't tell you how relieved I was to see her look so glad. She wanted my present first, probably because it was smallest. The most I'd been able to come up with was a paperback Western by one Frank O'Rourke. It was second-hand, which bothered none of us. I'd gotten it from the literate bachelor a block over, Mr. Haplin, who'd feigned haggling and accepted an Indian head penny in trade. "I'm sorry it's not a Zane Grey," I said. The fact was that Mr. Haplin, while an awfully good sport, collected Zane Greys. The Zane Greys stayed put. "It's all right," said Swede, smoothing the cover. The book was called The Big 50. "It's about a buffalo hunter." I'd paged through. "It looks swell," she said. Then, "Daddy!" Because he'd laid on her bed an awkwardly wrapped package that came untaped with no help at all and revealed a great solemn typewriter, black as a Franklin stove, its round keys agleam. "Daddy!" Swede said again in disbelief. Grinning, he handed her another package, a ribboned ream of 20-pound bond. "Now put those cowpokes of yours in print." She touched the keys, ratcheted the carriage, pinched the curling ribbon, and waved inked fingers. I never saw Swede look happier than she did with that monstrous machine sinking in her bedclothes, as if her world were nothing but huge blue-skied future. But the smudges on her fingers made me think of the bruises I'd seen when her blouse rode up, and I wondered how much they hurt and how much she thought about them. "Thanks so much," she said, "and may we all be paid one day with looks such as she gave Dad." Then Davy, who'd smiled silently through everything so far, knocked us all flat by stepping out of the room and back in with a Texas stock saddle, fragrant and lustrous, on his shoulder. He said, "Someday you're going to need this," and laid it on the floor beside her bed. Swede opened her mouth and couldn't find a word in it. While loving all things Western, I doubt the facts of horse and saddle had ever occurred to her as real. They were simply poetry, though of the very best kind. Hammerhead roan and dancing bay pony, and now I mention it, Texas stock saddle. To Swede, such phrases just loped along, champing and snorting and kicking up clover. And rightly so. Take away such locutions, and who's Sunny Sundown? Just a guy out walking. So the spell of the West, cast already by Mr. Gray, settled about Swede like a thrown loop. There's magic in tack, as anyone knows who's been to horse sales. And a rub saddle, unexpected and pulled from nowhere, owns an allure only dolts resist. Swede's was a double-rigged Texan with red mohair cinches, tulle Mexican patterns on fender and skirt, and a hemp-worn pommel. It was well used, which I believe gave all our imaginations a pleasing slap, and it had also arrived quixotically. Davy had bought it off a farmer who'd bought it off a migrant laborer who'd traded his horse for a windbroke Dodge truck on a dirt road north of Austin. The migrant had said goodbye to his loyal beast, but kept the saddle out of sentiment. Days later, under northern skies, he He understood that its presence in the pickup only made him heartsick, and he unloaded it cheap to the farmer, who, though confused by Spanish, understood burdens and the need to escape them. All this, Davy told us, with Swede astride the saddle on her bedroom floor. Davy's work had brought the thing back to near perfection. The smell of soaped leather, which is like that of good health, rose around us. It was flawed only in the cantle, where the leather had split and pulled apart. Davy acknowledged with frustration that this must have happened years ago, and that he was unable to mend it. "But it doesn't matter for riding," he said. "That's true," Swede said practically, just as if there were a pony out waiting in the yard. Well, the day defined extravagance. Though wisdom counsels against yanking out all stops, Swede did seem joyously forgetful of recent evils, and we kept the momentum as long as we could. Waffles for breakfast, sugar lumps dipped in saucers of coffee. I remember it as October days are always remembered, cloudless, maple-flavored, the air gold and so clean it quivers. After lunch, toasted cheese sandwiches. Dad opened the coat closet and with great care unfolded something scarlet, crinkled, shroud-like. When he called it a balloon, I was confused at first, thinking of the rubber kind. This one was of tissue paper and at least 10 feet high. It had an open bottom weighted with a circle of wire. In the backyard, Swede and I held the bottom of the bag while Dad lit a coffee can mixture of gas and No. 2 fuel oil. Heat fattened in minutes, the balloon commenced to tug. When it was pulling hard enough to lift a good-sized cat, Dad set a hubcap atop the can to quench the fire, and we let it go. It went up quickly. A light wind slipped in from the east, and the balloon caught it, tilted a little, then righted into a smooth, angled ascent. When the balloon was a dark bug on a pale blue wall, Dad jogged Swede with his elbow. "Ah, Swede," he said. 9 years. A car horn sounded out front. Davy trotted around and came back looking like he'd burped sour. He said, "Dad, it's Lurvy." Swede looked aggrieved. She said nothing aloud, to her credit. "All right," Dad said. His carriage drooped an inch or so. I won't say it didn't, but you couldn't have guessed a thing from his face. The horn honked again, and Dad went around front and laughed boldly once and told Tin Lurvy to come in for coffee. Picture a fat man, suit full of sweat spots, knees pointing inward for support. Imagine the voice of a much picked on yet somehow hopeful child. If John Calvin was right, destiny had a serious grudge against Tin Lurvy, a purple-faced, futile, tragically sociable traveling salesman. Had he only been pushy, he wouldn't have been a problem. Dad never minded hurrying Fuller Brushmen along. But Lurvy didn't push. In fact, he never mentioned what he was selling unless you asked. I suspect few people did. Merchandise didn't seem to matter much to Lurvy, except his conversation. Garrulous conversation, too, because Lurvy preferred to run about 1/4 drunk. Along American turnpikes, he had failed to peddle vacuum cleaners, saucepans, patent medicines, candy, cufflinks, hair pieces. I didn't know all this at the time, but would learn it soon, gracefully worded in his obituary. Though he probably came through roofing but once or twice yearly, it was more than enough to establish him as a kind of mean joke among us clannish kids. One Christmas Eve, the dishes done, the Gospel of Luke read aloud, presence imminent, Davy looked out the window and said, "Oh no, Tin Lurvy's driving up." The bluff dropped my organs into my shoes. Worse, it turned prophetic. Lurvy really was driving up, except he was only as far as Michigan at the time. Come New Year's Eve, 10 p.m., popcorn rattling in the pan, Swede and I looking ahead to the one time all year we'd see midnight. Lurvy drove up for real. Atop the stove were 4 glossy carameled apples, one for each of us to eat at the stroke of 12. Lurvy ate Dad's. The arrival of Tin always turned your day in unexpected directions. Here we'd been trying to give Swede a birthday to make her troubles flee. Now we wanted to flee as well. It had to be done quickly, if at all. Otherwise, protocol took hold, like the death rigor, requiring a person to respect company and sit and listen. In the case of Lurvy, to pointless recitations about people you didn't know, most of them Democrats, Illinois Democrats, Delaware Democrats, Ohio Democrats. Gracious, how Lurvy admired them all.
The Democratic Party is the best family I got,
Lurvy liked to declare, a truer statement than any of us knew. So while Dad started a pot of coffee and hunted around for cookies, Swede gathered Davy and me behind the house.
It's my birthday, she said. I didn't invite Mr. Lurvy.
She never would have pouted so in Dad's presence. It was unacceptable form. And anyhow, there was something about the fat salesman that brought out the Samaritan in Dad. We all recognized this, including Lurvy. The advantage was all his.
Maybe if Dad bought something from him, he'd go away, I suggested.
Swede was suspicious.
What's he selling?
Encyclopedias, Davy said. World book encyclopedias. They cost a couple $100. From inside, we could hear Dad setting out cups and opening cupboards, and also the cheerful insensibility of Lurvy's opening monologue, the sounds of hope landing face down. Swede said,
I'll just go in and help Dad find the cookies.
Poor duty-racked girl. She was almost crying.
No, let's go to the timber, Davy said.
Let him find the cookies, Swede. He knows where they are. The timber was a 100-acre woodlot at the edge of roofing, wherein lay solace for the hard hit.
No, he doesn't, Swede said bitterly. He doesn't.
They don't need cookies anyway, Davy said. Then, grinning, let him eat cake, which brought a giggle from Swede. There was a joke here I didn't get, but she shook her head and replied sagely,
the cake's what I'm trying to save.
It was her birthday, after all. I suppose she'd baked that cake herself. Gathering all possible drama, she said,
if I'm not back in 2 minutes, you guys go on without me.
And you know what? She wasn't back. Not in 2 minutes, or 5, or 10. Then Davy said, let's pull out, Rube. And peeking through the window, I saw poor Swede installed at the kitchen table, tall glass of milk in front of her, a single desolate cookie lying untouched on a saucer, and lament in her eyes. Dad, by now, looked not just patient, but downright indulgent with Lurvy, whom I could hear talking through the glass.
I tell you, I ordered me an Airstream trailer. 20 foot. Got a bathroom in it with running water. Even a pot.
It grieved us, leaving Swede that way. But she volunteered, so off we tramped down County Blacktop. The afternoon was still bright and smelled of wheat stubble and warm dust. Sometimes we stepped down into the high-killed grass to spook hares out of the ditch. Davy had snagged his little carbine out of the garage. But we weren't really hunting, and he didn't pull on any of the hares, just sighted down the barrel at them, zigzagging away. The timber, I should tell you, was one of the best places God ever made. The trees were mostly bur oaks, wide, knuckly giants whose leaves in autumn turned deep brown and beetle-back shiny. Dried, those leaves were so stiff you could feel them through the soles of your shoes. A fellow named Draper owned the land then, a happy old crank, and he ran a few independent Jersey cows on its land to keep the grass down. In the timber, we'd seen badgers, mink, fox, an overconfident fisher stretched out smiling on a limb, these beyond the usual million gray squirrels and woodchucks. Also in spring and fall were crows by the dozens, shiny-eyed, bellicose buggers swaying in the high branches, cawing and losing their balance and flapping languidly. Abruptly, Davy asked, "Did you see Swede's bruises?" I nodded. She didn't say anything. I just saw by accident.
You think Dad knows?
I didn't, really.
Maybe?
We kicked on toward the deepest part of the timber. The deader oak leaves get, the more noise they make. My lungs were getting a little stiff on the intake, and Davy was keeping a quick, frustrated pace.
You think, he said, that Dad is afraid?
I stopped, had to, crouched for breath.
Afraid of what?
I'll admit my mind was occupied. Sometimes when the breathing goes, it goes like that, like smoke filling a closet.
Finch and Bosca, are you okay, Rube?
I nodded, shut my eyes, took in as much air as I could, and let it out slow, all the way out, down to the bottom. I said,
he's not afraid of those guys. He beat them up in the locker room that night.
Davy said nothing. Maybe that was what had him so irritable. He thought Dad was scared. Maybe it scared him in turn, or maybe he just thought it was weakness. Finally, he said,
Are you scared, Rube?
Nah.
He watched me breathe for a while. You think God looks out for us?
Well, yeah,
I said. And Davy asked, you want him to? I nodded, thinking, what an oddball question.
We had a strange encounter in the timber that day. We came across a tramp, curled up, hound-like, beside a ruined fire. We heard him snoring, is how it happened, sawing away like Sunday afternoon. Pushing through undergrowth, we crept forward till we saw two shiny black things, lying one atop the other. They turned out to be the soles of two shoes, which became attached to a set of ragged stockings, then the gray pants of some throwaway business suit. At last we stood in a tiny clearing amid dead brush, looking down at a small red-haired, red-bearded fellow, sleeping away most desperately, his back propped against an army duffel. He hadn't a single gray hair that I could see. I suppose he was in his 30s at most. But his legs were so thin and socks bagged, and the grit of decades seemed settled in his face. I remember the smells of cold fire and old sandwich meat and another that was new to me then. A sorrowful taint as of long disuse, the smell of a room not opened in years. We left the tramp lying there, us boys a little stunned at such need for sleep. We backed away and didn't speak, and moved a bit more quietly through the timber going home. We never saw the man again. I'm not even sure why I mention him here. It's not as if he pops up later holding a clue or moral or other momentous piece of story. It's tempting, certainly, to assign him the duty of harbinger. He'd make a good one, so worn and desiccated beside his sorry coals. But I doubt he was. A tramp can just be a plain tramp, you know. He can build a fire in someone's favorite woods, even ours. It was a strange moment, is all. But when we stepped out from the woods, stepped out into a peevish wind, the sky telling of winter, evening-colored at 4 in the afternoon, shouldn't I have felt something then? As we walked toward home, toward lighted windows, shouldn't I have sensed the lands adrift, pushed off course, gone wayward? Supper that night was Swede's favorite, a red potato chowder Dad mixed up with hunks of northern pike. Seasoned with vinegar and pepper, this was our king of soups. A person didn't even want to put crackers in it. My heart sank when I entered the kitchen and saw Dad standing at the stove, nodding and stirring while Lurvy talked on. His senses roused by the aroma of creamed pike and reds, Lurvy was expounding on his most cherished road meal of all time. A bowl of fisherman's stew he'd ordered in Seattle at a place called Ivor's Acres of Clams. Yes, Ivor knew his mollusks. Proficient biologist as well as canny gourmet, Ivor knew where the best clams resided, stalked the beaches himself daily to shovel them up fresh, and so on. I felt we were being set up, that no matter how delicious Dad's batch of chowder, we would all be subjected during its consumption to a comparison with Ivor's wondrous clams, in which our king of soups would be reduced to something along the lines of a jack. I saw this coming, and perhaps Davy did too, because he said, with mild impertinence, "Where's your next stop, Mr. Lurvy? Do you have a long way to go?" But Lurvy only smiled. "No schedule stop, son. It's thoughtful of you to ask. Interested in traveling, are you? Well, let me tell you about a little seafood place I found up in the Cascades." Meantime, I peeked into the pan Dad was stirring and became alarmed. Why, he'd only made a regular batch. With Lurvy at the table, he ought to have tripled it. Even I knew that. Lurvy could eat this much all by himself without noticing. Inside my mind, we all sat down, Lurvy to our prize soup and the rest of us to bread and butter. I imagine Lurvy slurping joyously, pausing only to denigrate the broth. I saw the final spoonful vanish. I heard his belch of conquest. "Something wrong, Reuben?" Dad said. I looked stricken, I guess. "Is this all the soup?" Dad grinned, saying, "Well, of course." And for a moment, I understood Davy's chronic impatience, Sometimes it really was as if Dad had no clue at all.
Lurvy said, "Better wash your hands, kids. No dirty fingers at this table."
And then, without rising to wash his own, reached for the napkins Dad had laid out and tucked two of them into the top of his shirt. The soup, I must tell you, was peerless. The beloved Ivor himself must have authored no such broth, for Lurvy said nothing of clams, or Seattle, or anything that might detract from the present delectation. He ate a bowl in owlish silence, confounded, I guess, by excellence. And seeing this, we kids all ate the faster, comparing the man's appetite with the humble size of the soup pot. "More tin?" Dad offered, and Lurvy held up his bowl. With that second helping, the silence broke. Lurvy had found joy at our table and settled in as though home from the wars. Spooning up soup, he looked benevolently around the table at the four of us. He said, "I had my appendix out last month. They showed it to me when I come to. It was yellow as paint and 6 inches long. Your normal appendix goes about 3.5. Did you know that?" Well, none of us had known it until that moment. Perhaps if we'd owned World Book, we would have. But there commenced an education on appendixes and their ailments and removal, Lurvy's in particular, that, speaking for myself, I'd rather have heard after supper. Between spoonfuls, Lurvy told us how your appendix is shaped like a worm and hangs leech-like onto your large intestine, how it can go bad with no warning whatever and land a normal, happy person in a world of hurt. He told how his own appendix had grown beyond its intended duty, the nature of which eludes doctors to this day, until it almost did him in. He was sitting in a tavern in Pennsylvania, talking to a purveyor of dark German ales, a good Democrat, incidentally, when he felt faint and stood to clear his head. Next thing he was on his back, conscious only of a fertile nausea and an awful groaning, such as sick cats make, and of the ale man kneeling above, pinching Lurvy's nose shut and kissing him like the world would end. "Did you kiss him back?" Swede said, aghast. Lurvy held up his bowl. Dad ladled in soup. Resuscitating cloudily, his mind befogged, Lurvy could only assume that the ale man had lost his wits, and also that the prolonged and strangely pneumatic smooch was the source of the nausea. "What would you do?" Lurvy asked us. "Wouldn't you lurch upward, trying to get away? And if your forehead happened to crack the ale man's nose and knock him colder than a Catholic mackerel, was that your fault?" He told how, when the ambulance arrived, it was obliged to cart them both off, the pending appendectomy and the sleeping ale man, whose nose, Lurvy said, lay dead flat against his face. "Who'd like more chowder?" Dad asked. "Me," Lurvy answered. The operation had gone well enough, except the anesthetic hadn't been applied appropriate to Lurvy's great size, and he remained frowsy throughout, asking the surgeon what that thing was, and whether he'd washed his hands, and once believing he was 8 years old again, having his tonsils out. During this disclosure, Lurvy ate at least 5 bowls of soup. Could have been 6, things run together under the spell of epics. I myself had only 1 bowl, the last spoonful of which had just entered my mouth when Lurvy took off describing his diseased appendix, all yellow and foul, like some pusworm dropped in a doctor's pan. The image stopped my supper then and there, but had no effect on Swede, who ate, I believe, 3 bowls, probably out of principle, it being her birthday. Later, after cake, when Lurvy had gone, Dad admitted he had had 2 bowls of soup despite the morbid narrative. He was a little wide-eyed at the integrity of his own broth, asking Swede, "What did I put in it? Did we fix this batch differently? My goodness." All this from a pot of soup meant to feed the 4 of us and no more. A small pot of soup. Was I the only one who noticed how many bowls were served? How the pot was replenished as though from a well? How there was somehow enough again and again to fill the ladle? Cleaning up the dishes after supper, I felt a surprising weight in the faithful vessel and, lifting the lid, beheld a pot still more than half full of our king of soups. Make of it what you will. But onward. Between supper and what came later, I remember a cold rain dripping off the eaves as Lurvy's taillights eased away. I remember Swede's head against my shoulder and her saying, "You think it'll turn to snow, Reuben?" "Oh, I hope it turns to snow." I remember Dad moving slowly in the house, a terrible headache having taken him almost the moment Lurvy departed, walking stooped, Reaching to turn off lights that hurt his eyes, Dad tripped over Swede's saddle, which she dragged into the living room. When she ran to him, he said, "Don't worry, don't worry," and picked up the saddle and carried it to her bedside. But his head was ringing with a pain visible at the edges of eyes and mouth. Swede and I went to bed early. Davy slung on a coat and left the darkened house. I lay wakeful, conscious of breathing, discomforted at Dad's stumble, at the pain that blinded him. And I wondered again about Swede's bruises, how much they'd cost her in fear alone. Rising, I looked out the window. Davy's lit tobacco was an orange dot in the rain. I crossed the hall, whispering, "Swede, are you awake?" But she was already far gone into night, mouth open, her breathing faintly snotty. I was pleased to see the big 50 turned on the outspread pages beside her bed. She'd gotten a ways in before the day overtook her. Beneath the rain-shot window, the saddle camped in a pearly glow. It drew me. I knelt and touched the leather, the soft polish of long miles, the gentle orderly smell of horse and pace soap. There's magic in tack, as I said before, and it's no embellishment to say that saddle seemed almost to breathe and sigh in some easy creaking dream of the West, just as Swede was likely doing. I ran my hand down the slope of the horn, down the slick sitting place, and up the swept cantle, and that's when I noticed that the flaw, the pulled-apart leather Davy had been unable to fix, that he apologized for, was gone. I felt with both hands, though the saddle in its luminosity showed me well enough that the breach in the leather had closed. The wound had simply healed up. I felt a comfortable strangeness, as if smiled upon by someone behind my back. I sat on my haunches there in Swede's cool room and remembered how Dad, after stumbling over the saddle, had picked it up in his patient hands and carried it here and set it down again. I touched the cantle, just smooth leather, not even a seam. Make of that what you will. Sometime past midnight, the rain turned to snow. I could tell by the difference in the sound against the window, a less sharp, wetter sound. At first, I thought that was what wakened me. Then the door handle turned, the back door off the kitchen. I knew that little squeal, how I wanted it to be Davy coming in, smoky and quiet and shaking off water. But Davy was inside already, sleeping not 5 feet from me, breathing through his nose in satisfied drafts. Nor was it Dad, for I could hear him, too, rolling to and fro in sleep, wrestling his headache. I heard the dry complaint of the kitchen floor, of the place beside the broom closet where joists groaned underfoot, and if I'd had any doubt that someone had got inside the house, it vanished when a damp current of air came in and touched my ears and forehead. Davy smacked, swallowed, sank to yet more earnest sleep. My lungs shrank with expectation. My whole surface hurt. I ached to creep across and wake him, but felt benumbed, crippled. Now, for the first time, I heard real footsteps. They crossed the living room. A shoulder bumped the mantelpiece. My windowpane filled with a burst of driven snow, and I abandoned myself to the knowledge that I'd waited too long to wake Davy. What would happen now would happen. The steps came forward. They stopped at my door. I felt, more than heard, someone's hand upon the knob. Then Davy spoke from beside me. "Switch on the light." His voice, so soft, he might have been talking in his sleep, but he wasn't. He was talking to whomever stood incorporeal in the doorway. "Switch it on," he commanded, and next thing we were all of us, bright-soaked and blinking, me beneath my quilt, and Israel Finch standing in the door with a baseball bat in one hand and the other still on the switch, and poor stupid Tommy, all a squint behind his shoulder. Davy was sitting up in bed in his T-shirt, hair askew. Somehow he was holding the little Winchester he'd carried in the timber that afternoon, and holding it comfortably, elbows at rest on his knees, his cheek against the stock, as if to plink tin cans off fence posts. It is fair to say that Israel had no chance. I'm not saying he deserved one. He stood in the door with his pathetic club like primal man, squinting at extinction. How confused he looked. How pink-eyed and sweaty. Then he lifted the bat, the knothead, and Davy fired, and Israel went backward into Tommy Boska, and Davy levered up a second round and fired again. Did you ever hear a rifle shot inside a house? Inside a plastered room? You may imagine how the place came alive, even while the opposite was happening for Israel Finch. He had no last murmur that I could detect. The round made a bright black raindrop above and between his two eyebrows, so that Swede, much later, would write that his corpse lay painted like a Brahmin maid. He was on his back in the hallway with that dot on his forehead and no exit wound behind. A good argument, Dr. Noakes would bluntly note, for small calibers. When Swede came flying from her room, she saw, beside Finch, Tommy Boska on his stomach, with hands a-quiver toward the door, and Davy stepping up behind him. And she saw me, I suppose, me watching the end of all our lives as we had lived them heretofore. I remember the sound of Swede's gasping voice and her exhaled huff as Dad yanked her into the bathroom and slapped the door shut. I looked at Tommy Boska, who was shot too, though not cleanly as was Finch. Tommy clawed the floor, bawling incomprehensibly, and his eyes rolled, and there was genuine terror inside his voice, and I knew with certainty he was seeing all the devils waiting for him, whetting their long knives, that he could hear their gabbling shrieks, that the smell of sulfur so quick in the room issued from some dim mouth-like chamber, panting after his soul. Standing above him, Davy levered up a third cartridge. I ought have looked away, but couldn't. He lowered the barrel to the base of Tommy Boska's skull. For an instant, my brother seemed very small, like a stranger seen at a clear distance. He showed no tremor. He fired. Tommy relaxed. The house went quiet except for Swede, sobbing behind the bathroom door. The sulfur smell hung a moment, then faded. Davy straightened, not looking at me or Dad, who emerged with arms scratched red from restraining Swede. Davy wiped his face, said, "Well," then stepped over Tommy and out the door. And when did he know just what he'd done? We've wondered that, Swede and I. When did it come to Davy Land that exile is a country of shifting borders? Hard to quit, yet hard to endure, no matter your wide shoulders, no matter your toughened heart. Peeking at Eternity. No one would be more annoyed than Davy if I tried to recast the predicament under some redemptive glow. Two boys were dead in our house, and there was no bright side to the matter. I recall Davy sitting on the basement stairs under a yellow bulb, jacket dragged on over his T-shirt, his face oily with rain. He wouldn't speak, and his eyes showed a narcosis that was fearful to me. We waited together for Ted Pullet to arrive. Dad, far gone in prayer, held Swede in one arm and gripped Davy's shoulder with the other. I recall a sensation of splitting in two, of becoming smaller. I babbled to Davy that it would be all right, that he had not meant to do it, which woke him from wherever he'd been, for he turned and snared my wrist. "Don't say it's all right, Rube. Don't say it. I meant to do it. I meant to. You hear me?" I could only nod frantically. Cars had driven up while he spoke, and we heard doors thumping and voices and saw red lights bouncing off the windows. Davy said, "Here we go, then." He was always impatient with our family's general insistence that things turn out for the best. True story. In the spring of Dad's 28th year, he was raised up by a tornado, along with most of the roof above him and a few loose boards he was setting into the floor. This was when he was married to my mother, attending a little school in Iowa under the GI Bill. In those days, Dad's love of books and scholarly quest kept him happily consumed. He was one of those honorably ambitious, self-educated men loved by American folklorists, a Lincoln-hearted reader who might walk 10 miles to borrow a volume of poetry by John Donne or a novel by Melville, or, to be particularly honest about it, Owen Wister. Loving to study and possessed of unusual compassion, he leaned naturally towards medicine, and I imagine my mother falling easily for this generous and handsome and obviously rising young man. To this day, in fact, it's easy for me to conjure the look our lives might have had if Dad had but held course. An unassuming farmhouse with a wide swept porch, surrounded, I'm guessing, by a few head of Angus beef on a pastoral acreage, because a doctor needs his recreation, a couple good quarter horses in a painted corral, Mom coming out the back door, slapping flour off her apron, calling us kids for supper, looking pleased and content. Surprising, isn't it, how close such pictures lie beneath the surface? From what I've heard, those were fine times. Davy was a year old and tottered roguishly around the glad-hearted poverty of married student housing. Mother fed him and wore thin from the chase and read him to sleep from Robert Louis Stevenson. Dad studied the bones of the science department's hanging skeleton, name of Yorick, a short, scurvied fella gone the color of weak tea. Professor of Dad's told him Yorick was no conscientious volunteer, but was instead a hard-luck Calcuttan who'd been dredged from the Ganges River and been boiled clean and had ridden the black market to the American Midwest. It made a person think. When not studying, Dad worked sweeping and painting in the athletic building 20 hours a week, unknowingly getting all the education he was going to need right there in his coveralls. It was the athletic building, Dewey Hall, that the tornado struck, just past 11, one heat-soaked night in September. This, by the way, is the only story Dad ever told us in whispers, how the tornado came cruising up out of the south, birthed from a yellow cloud, how it touched earth at the fringe of town, a pale umbilical rope to corkscrew almost shyly up College Drive, gathering dirt but little else. Next morning, the first thing emergent residents noticed was their street, swept like never before, and all street-side grass calmed and pointed, as if in praise to some passing magnificence. Dad was working late, installing new floorboards on the basketball court where a light fixture had fallen the previous winter. It just worked loose and fell, interrupting a home game, injuring no one but thrilling the crowd with its descent and powdery detonation. Dewey Hall was the only building on campus not made of brick, and the tornado came for it in absolute maturity. No umbilical growth now, but a strong, slender lady hip walking through campus, past the science hall, past English, jumping Old Main in the library with deliberate grace and lighting on the shallow roof of Dewey, where Dad toiled alone. He said it didn't sound like a train, as the wisdom goes, but like a whole mountain breaking loose and skidding sideways over the ground. And looking up, he saw shingles in the air and bits of skylight glass hovering in slow circles. He saw incandescent fixtures likewise floating, torn from their sockets, yet filaments whole and gloriously charged by some storm-bent physics. And as he sprang for the basement steps, not 50 feet away, he heard the great slab of ceiling tear loose and felt himself move upward, ascending in bodily confusion out of the range of gravity and earth and earthly help. Meantime, my mother, awakened in their third-floor garret by the hissing wind, leapt up in time to see the rotating head of the funnel coast overhead, lit municipally from below. Gusts of sand raked the panes. No accumulation of hard feelings can diminish my admiration for what she did then, which was to fly nightgowned into Davy's tiny room, seize a folded quilt, and brace it against his window. Thus she stood while the noise rose from a hiss to a many-noted baying. Thus she stood as all lights failed and glass burst elsewhere in the building, and the noise became everything a mind could hold. As Dad told the story, this was always the moment of triumph, the turn of the war toward winning. Mother is leaning against the window, standing between the gale and little Davy, and at the storm's very crest, when it is like a war come seeking what it might devour, she feels the slightest easing in the glass. At the same time, Davy stirs and smacks. He rolls to his stomach. The glass goes still beneath her hands, and by the time Davy settled back into sleep, the war's moved on to the north. But do you think the worst is over? Remember, Dad is only now on the ascent. Hammer in hand, he's peeking at eternity. Mom's tears of relief are just standing at the corners of her eyes. Nope, the worst for Mom, at least, is still to come. First thing she did, Dad told us, after the storm moved on, was to run out groping for the hall telephone they shared with the third floor. To ring up Dewey, of course. To check on Dad. The line was dead, no surprise. But a strange thing. The handset was hot. not warm as if from someone's hand, but hot, charged, voltage-goosed. Mother had it to her ear before her palm registered pain. Later, she would say the scorched phone scared her more than the storm. It seemed outside of nature. It foretold evil. Dropping it, she felt her way back and pulled Davy from his crib and held him for comfort. I imagine them at the window she stood braced against, looking across campus, but you couldn't see Dewey Hall from there. The lights were still out, and anyhow, Old Main stood up between them. Within the hour, someone knocked. In the dark, wrapped in a robe, Mother opened the door to a small committee of men, their lantern-lit faces the color of burning paper. The man in front said, "Mrs. Land, Dewey Hall is down." And there it was, the worst. She heard them out, their descriptions of the torn building, the void where the roof had been, the twists of painted siding and electrical wire and ruinous plankage spread northward in a long, littered swath. They'd taken lanterns and hoisted wreckage and found no sign of Mr. Land. Others were searching even now. They needn't have told my mother she should prepare for still harder tidings, but they were clumsy fellows and no doubt completely at sea. Was there a right way to deliver the sort of news they carried? As to my mother's state of mind in those next hours, I can only guess. Once in my life I knew a grief so hard I could actually hear it inside, scraping at the lining of my stomach, an audible ache, dredging with hooks as rivers are dredged when someone's been missing too long. I have to think my mother felt something like that. Maybe Davy woke and distracted her. Maybe she was numb. Maybe she had the reserves to begin planning, even then, how best to make her way in the world that had been so friendly only the night before. All I know for sure, from Dad's telling, is this. She was at the kitchen table late that morning, having dressed and fed Davy and set him to riding his rain footstool, when the hall phone, restored to service, began to ring. She sat a long while, wanting someone else to get it, but the whole floor had emptied, gone to class and to work and to walk blinking round the former Dewey Hall. At last she got up and answered. A woman asked for Mrs. Jeremiah Land. "Speaking?" said my mother. "Did your car survive the storm, Mrs. Land?" the woman asked. My mother said sharply, "What are you talking about? Be patient with her now. Think of her long night." "Mrs. Land," the woman said, "I'm Mariana Evans. Our farm is 4 miles north of town. I got a man here drinking coffee on my porch. He says he's your husband." Well, we all hold history differently inside us. For Swede, such episodes retold themselves into seamless and momentous narrative. She had a Homeric grasp of the significance of events, and still does. One of her recent letters asks, "Is it hubris to believe we all live epics?" Perhaps it is, but I suspect she's not actually counting on me for an answer. Dad, he himself would say, was baptized by that tornado into a life of new ambitions, interpreted by many, including my mother, as a life of no ambitions. Finishing out that semester, he moved his family off campus and found work as a plumber's assistant.